I think that was, is that my water bottle, Susan? Yeah, I think that is. So it must be mine, or somebody else's, and I'll drink somebody's germs today. I guess as usual, I'll make some excuses up front. If I go into rambling about tearing up carpet that's laid down with glue on tile, or if I talk about remodeling instead of the Bible tonight, I'm sorry, but I didn't spend much time with the Bible. I spent more time with carpet this week and with tile and with waxing. So if I just go off onto that, I'm sorry. And also, I have to get used to this split kind of thing that we're doing here. But I'll have you guys help me out, as usual. Tonight, we're picking up where Rod left off last week. In John chapter 13, he covered the part where Jesus washes the feet of the disciples, and he talked a lot about the idea of being a servant and what that means. And he challenged all of you guys, including myself, to think about what we have on, the things that hinder us from being a servant. Tonight, we're going to continue that story and close this story out in chapter 13. But before we get there, I'm going to tell you a story that a lot of you have probably heard or participated in with me at some level. Before the village, and if you've heard this story, you can fill in the parts maybe that I get wrong. But before the village started and was the village, I attended El Camino Baptist Church. And at that church, there was this college, singles, married kind of thing that happened in my house. And through a lot of transitions and stuff, that whole ministry ended up kind of in what you could say in limbo. We ended up not at the church, not because we'd done anything wrong. We just sort of were pushed out because they had a new pastor, and it's a lot of different things. They're not important. We ended up being in this huge transition, and I was leading that along with some other people. And as we entered into this transition where we had no connections to anybody, and we were just a bunch of single, young people and some married people hanging out, this pastor showed up at my house. Well, through some other, connections, like my father, he ended up at my house. And he was a young pastor, and he was excited about what we were doing, and he was excited about his new church that he had. And he really wanted our ministry to be connected to his church, because he was really wanting to make this big transition with his church. And so he really pursued me in a way that I had never been pursued in my life before. And he really poured himself into me, wanted to spend time with me, wanted to teach me whatever he knew, wanted to learn stuff from me. And it was really cool. It was so cool that he convinced me that this was a good idea. And so I, along with some other of the leaders, attempted to convince 60 people in limbo that they should join another church with us. And so some of them actually agreed to that. And I mean, I was really excited. And the elders of this young guy's church were excited too. And I drew this great flow chart about how we were going to blend the churches and how we were going to have this really cool, neat worship service. And I was really excited. And so we joined the church. Now, the church was a Presbyterian church, and I'm not Presbyterian in any way, and so I had to learn a lot about Calvinism, and for you who know about Calvinism, you know the stretch that is, but I made it, and I made that, and I joined the church with my wife, with Keith and Julie, and with some other people, and 2 weeks later, a day after I had actually shown the pastor my flow chart, and I'd shown the elders my flow chart, and they were all excited. And a day later, I was sitting with this guy, and he said, "Well, I don't think I'm cut out for ministry, and I don't think this is what God wants me to do. So I'm leaving the church." After I joined, 2 weeks later, I'm like, "What are you talking about? What's going on here?" I was so excited, and I felt betrayed. I mean, I had gone up with this guy to California. I took a seminary class with him. I was just sort of falling around. He was my mentor. And he just disappeared. I mean, 2 weeks later, he was in Texas studying to be a sign manager, you know, like those fast sign kind of things. And he left the ministry altogether. And I was just really hurt. But I didn't really feel that too much. I just sort of got a little depressed and then shoved it off. And as I was reading this passage, well, first off, you have to know another story. Mike has been living in my house for 2 years, and I love Mike. And we all love Mike. Are you here, Mike?
Who's Mike? Right here.
There's Mike.
No, he's not here.
I love Mike. And Mike's a really good guy. But Mike was sleeping in my special room. See, I had painted, if you can tell, I really like space and I really like color. And so I painted this little room in our house, and it hardly has any furniture in it, and it's very cozy, and that's where I pray and where I spend time with God. And so then Mike moved in there because we wanted Mike to move in there. And then I stopped spending time with God because he took my room. And so for the last... So for the last 2 years, if things have been dry and bad from up here, it's because Mike has been in my room. But no, that's not true. On Tuesday, I was sitting in Mike's old room, in my prayer room, and I was just laying on the bed. And as I was reading this passage, I just began to weep because for the first time, I just started feeling all of those emotions of having this guy just kind of stabbed me in the back. And I thought, no, not Mike. Mike didn't stab me in the back. This young pastor. And you know, I still like him, and we still talk, or we have talked. So, but I was feeling the pain of that feeling of being betrayed. And it was very hard for me to focus. But I felt like maybe I could identify with where Jesus was at in our story. Because, you see, Jesus is at the end of his ministry. Jesus has spent 2 years with these guys, with these 12 guys, with the future of Christianity. And one of them, whom he's poured all his time into, is going to betray him. And I love this scene. In all the Gospels, I love this scene because I can imagine like the movie of this part. I can see like the tumbleweeds blowing down, you know, the street, and here are these 12 men in this upper room, and you can hear the wind and like rattling the windows, and they're all like, remember what Rod explained this, they're all basically laying on each other, smelling each other's feet, but it's intense. You can feel the emotion. And here's Jesus, he strips off his clothes and he washes their feet, and you can just feel the intimacy here. And in this room, in this place where there's deep, passionate relationship, one person is going to just wreck all of that. And Jesus is, in a sense, desperate now for his disciples to understand the basic parts of things. And so we start in verse 18 of chapter 13 of John. It says, I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I have chosen. His scriptures may be fulfilled. He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me. For now on, I am telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. Jesus is talking about Judas. And he's saying, and this is interesting because we've run into Jesus doing this. He begins to tell people things that are going to happen so that they will believe. He begins to put those markers in their lives so they can say, oh, Judas betrayed you. You said that. Oh, it helps their belief. And it's interesting that he uses this passage out of Psalm 41 about the heel being raised up. There's a bunch of different things that that can mean, but mostly it means the hoof of a horse kicking. And so like he's basically saying he's being kicked by a horse. This is what Judas is doing to him, is being kicked by a horse's hind. And then he says, okay, whoever receives me, or whoever receives the one who sent me, receives me, and whoever receives me, him who sent me. Whoa, I got that mixed up. Let me see that again. Verse 20. True, true, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. So he says, so basically he says, okay, Judas is going to betray me, but those of you who embrace me, it's going to be okay. In this movement, and things will be all right. And in verse 21 it says, when Jesus had said this, he became troubled in spirit and testified and said, truly, truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me. The disciples began looking at one another, at a loss to know which one he was speaking. There was reclining on Jesus' breast the one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter, therefore, gestured to him and said to him, tell us who it is of whom he is speaking. He leaned back thus on Jesus' breast and said to him, Lord, who is it? Jesus therefore answered, This is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him. So when he had dipped the morsel, he took and gave to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. It's interesting. I don't know if this is completely true, but likely for Jesus to work this out, whoever the beloved disciple is laying on one side of Jesus, and then Judas is laying on the other side of Jesus. And Judas is actually in the highest place of position. To be next to Jesus is one of the best places. So here's the one who's going to betray him. And so when Jesus says, someone's going to betray me, and Peter kind of gets the youngest, who's John most likely, well, why don't you ask Jesus? You're right there. Ask Jesus. The only two people who hear this is Judas and John. The rest of them don't have a clue. So Jesus is basically leaning over on next to Judas, dipping his bread in the juice and whispering to Judas. And so probably only John is able to hear this. And it says in verse 27, and after the morsel, Satan then entered into him. Jesus therefore said to him, what you do, do quickly. Now no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he had said this to him. For some were supposing, because Judas had the money, that Jesus was saying to him, buy the things that we have need of for the feast, or else that he should give something to the poor. And so after receiving a morsel, he went out immediately, and it was night. When therefore he had gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of glorified and God glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God also will also glorify him in himself and glorify him immediately. Little children, I am with you a little while longer. You shall seek me, and as I said to the Jews, I now say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, and you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered, where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow later. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you. Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a cock will not crow until you deny me three times. You can feel, again, the intensity of this scene. Because, do you remember when Jesus says, Lazarus and Thomas is like, let's go then and die with him. And Peter is like, why can't I follow you? Why can't I be part of this rebellion? Why can't I be part of the action? They're all ready for something. They're all ready to die, to make this movement happen. Obviously, up to this point in John, we are pretty sure the disciples don't know what's happening. They don't understand what Jesus is doing. They don't understand that Jesus is doing this whole rebellion, this whole thing that Jesus is doing is between Satan and Jesus and a part of redemption. And they're thinking, we're going to die killing the Romans. Or we're gonna make some kind of statement, and this guy has some kind of power that's unlike any of the other guys who've been saying they're Messiah. Because he can heal people, he raises people from the dead. So we have more hope than any other Messiah. And so you can feel the tension in this room. And for the next few chapters, Jesus is going to try desperately, up to chapter 17, to communicate to his disciples the key to what this whole movement is about. And tonight, what I want to camp on is just one very common verse that we hear a lot about, but I don't think we talk about much, or that we try to figure out what practical parts of. And that's verse 34. And it says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples or followers, if you love me, if you have love for one another." I think that Jesus says this earlier, and it says this in the Gospels. He says that what the greatest commandment is to love God with everything and to love your neighbor. And the question that I keep hitting on in my head is, what the heck does it mean to love? What does it really mean to love? I mean, you understand if I just say love one another. Okay. Well, we say that to each other all the time, and I don't think we do that. We don't love each other. I mean, we try. We don't spend any time talking about it. And so I want to do that. I talk about what it means to love one another. Put out by a guy named Putman. He's some Harvard sociologist. It's called Bowling Alone. And basically in that book, he goes through the statistics of how since the 70s, people don't do anything with anybody. And talks about how in New York even, there is actually services that have cropped up where women, and this is all above board, they're basically hired out friends for young men who are just too busy to have friends and too busy to have dinner with somebody. So they go and they call this woman and she has dinner with them, or this man, and they have dinner. And they pay them to have dinner with them. I want that job. If any of you would like to pay me to have dinner with you, I would be glad to come. And by my dinner. It talks about how the attendance of bowling clubs and of all the different kinds of community organizations and instruments has gone down. And how the average single person gets touched just like a hug, something like once or twice a month. That there isn't any community, that there isn't any kind of intimacy between people anymore. So I think for the church, this is a grand moment when we begin to love one another and we can show the world who Jesus is by simply interacting. So what does that mean, again, to love someone? Well, the word that Jesus used simply just means directed compassion. It means that I look at Steve or Gary, and it's not like I think, well, I wonder what Gary needs, so I'll get that for him. It's, I will consider Gary and then I will love him by giving him whatever he needs. That I think he needs. Maybe he doesn't need it, but I think he needs it after I've thought about it. So I'm going to direct my compassion to Gary. But even that seems a little, okay, so what does that mean? So the question I have for you is, how many of you actually spend more than 5 minutes sitting down and thinking about somebody in here and thinking out, what does that person need? I mean, do you actually do that in your everyday life? Is that something you would do? Sit down and say, I wonder what Benji needs. What is it that he really needs that I can offer to him? Once? Ever?
Well, what's your time frame?
What do you mean? Well, okay. Let's have that discussion. What does it look like to intentionally love one another? What does it mean to intentionally love one another? What is so profound about what you have to offer each other that the world doesn't already offer each other?
Ourselves.
What?
Ourselves.
Yourselves. What does that mean? Okay, friendship, companionship.
Whatever our ability to meet the needs of others.
Okay. So, you guys can shut that door. Of course, we have all that chicken wire up there at this point. But Ryan. So how would you reflect somebody's dignity back to them?
Just by interacting, reminding them who they are. But I mean, it's not something, when I think about it, it's not necessarily something I'm conscious of.
Right. Pat?
Isn't what people really want the most in general affirmation? Wouldn't it be that affirming the person
so affirming who people are by giving, offering them affirmation. Gary and then Ruth.
I think just, you know, looking at the context, you know, I had this come right after the feet washing thing and,
sure,
and looking at the contrast of Judas with the betrayal. I think, you know, he says, as I have loved you, just, you know, the whole service aspect, making yourself less for somebody, not being afraid to, you know, serve somebody, to lay right yourself down for them.
Ruth and then Benji. I think that's a good, I want to come back to your point. Benji, Ruth, then Benji, then Julie. And then I'm with.
I think it's to really listen to someone.
To really listen.
And even if you disagree, not to tear them down in the discussion, to hear them for what they say and what they're struggling with or what wherever they're at, and then listen, really listen.
Okay. Listening. Benji.
I'm going to say some more off of what Gary said. I think it's really selflessness. I think we have such a selfish society, and advertising and everything else builds this selfishness that Americans are. And I think in my life, really loving someone else is being selfless. And I'm not going to put this to really listening for who this person is and
what are the dreams that they have that are hidden? And what are the longings that they have that have been crushed? And then to walk with them in the process of becoming.
That's very good. So really kind of putting yourself aside and getting to know who the person is without.
I have a great example.
Okay, and then I'm going to shift this.
A few weeks ago, I approached a couple of people here because my granddaughter had gotten a guitar as a gift. And her parents are struggling with what do you do with a 13-year-old who has a guitar, and they said that's what she wants and all of that.
Right.
And so I asked a couple of people about how did they get their start on the guitar, and did they have any suggestions, which I passed on to my son and daughter-in-law and talked to my granddaughter about it. Now, what made me feel loved in that situation was the fact that nobody rolled their eyes toward heaven like, what is she asking me, you know?
Right.
Or I don't want to be bothered with this, or why did she ask me anything like that? But they took my question seriously, and they shared their life experience with how they had begun to learn their time. That, to me, was being enfolded.
So they really... your desire.
Said, respected it for the question that it was. Didn't talk down to me. Didn't give me any of that. I mean, I've raised children. You know, I've seen their eyeballs go heaven. But I mean, I just felt enfolded. So I think that's a good example.
That's a very good example. I like this conversation. It's good. I want to shift it just a little bit. There's two things. Matthew 22, in that great statement that Jesus makes, he says that we should love one another the way we love ourselves. There's an assumption that we love ourselves. But in this culture, I think that's not necessarily an assumption we can always make. Some of us wrestle with that, even just loving our own self or other people's things. So I want to talk about that. But the other thing here is that Jesus says, you need to love other people the way I have loved you. So we have like four Gospels of Jesus loving 12 men and everyone around him. So the question to you guys then is how did, really, what did Jesus do? What did it make him different in the way he interacted with people and what he said that made it, that showed him loving people? How did Jesus love people? He joined in what God was already doing in other people's lives.
Right.
That's pretty.
That's not easy.
But we can do that.
It takes some consideration.
Gary?
He shared all of his insight. You know, he obviously, you know, had direct access to God the Father. He shared, you know, the words that God, you know, that God gave him. He shared those, but he didn't hold back. He shared everything he had.
That he offered. I'm going to go with Benji. Next.
The thing that really strikes me is how he directs his conversation to the apostles, to them, and not to the Bible, to the ages. He's really speaking directly to them, which then we can enter into. But he's not saying things that are just meaningless to them.
Right. So he considered people, and he offered what he had and spoke into their life. He made himself be vulnerable and allowed himself to be made poor, to look bad.
When they acted like idiots,
he was okay with that.
Idiot, but he was
all
right
with that. Susan? Was that Ryan? Ryan, I saw you had... Did you have your hand up? Mm-hmm. Oh.
On the ground with
his disciples. He stayed out there in the cold and the heat. And I bet he was probably the first one up in the morning to get the fire started and prepare breakfast for these people that he was serving and let people just go ahead and say bad things about him because they associated with them.
So he allowed his reputation to be mingled with the people he ministered to. I'm going to go Russ and then Julie and then Susan. Russ?
He
spent a lot of time. Okay. Julie?
He spoke directly to people's hearts rather than just the surface situation. He considered where they were. When they asked one question, he might answer a different question.
Right.
Because it was more relevant to their heart. And at the same time, he uncovered things in people, weaknesses in people, but it never, it wasn't in a shaming. It was in a, I know that this is true, but grace is here kind of way. And so it seems like when he revealed weakness, there was a gentleness to it that was true.
He provided people with a way out when he began to pull things out of their life.
Right.
Susan?
I think all the disciples were searching for something, and he gave them a new way to think about things, a new way to do things. Really spoke to just them needing to know the side of themselves that didn't know what to do about.
So he spoke to who they were and what they were longing for. Susan? He dispelled people's fears. Ruth, and then Pat, and then we'll move.
One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the story of Jesus' interaction with the woman at the well. And while he acknowledged her sin, he also redeemed her and gave her an opportunity to share and to regain some dignity and a life in the community of which she was a part.
So he gave people dignity. Wow. Pat?
And he treated, his disciples, he treated them all well and all with equal love, or else they would have known who the one was that was going to betray him. Nobody had a clue, they had to ask him.
Wow.
Wow.
So they had no clue about who, Judas at all, didn't
they?
Okay, so if that's how Jesus loved people, what do you think the world thinks about the church in general when they look at it?
Hypocrites.
Hypocrites. Okay, what else do they think about us?
Stuffy.
Self-righteous. Self-righteous. Judgmental.
Sanctimonious.
What was that? I didn't... You got to yell out loud, right?
Empty.
Conservative? Is that what I heard?
Well-dressed?
Impotent.
Arrogant.
I think often they think of them as nice people.
Nice people. No, I mean, okay.
Boring people.
Boring people?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you... Go?
And yet there's a lot of people who turn to the church for compassion or for food or for...
Sure.
Dental work or...
Right. So there's kind of... No. I think people do think that somehow these people who are stuffy, judgmental, and arrogant are also compassionate. It's sort of this weird duality. So what do you think your friends think of the village? What do they think of, not as a church and its philosophy, but as the people at the village? What? Weird. Okay, let's do this. What are the bad things that you think people might see? Not the non-good.
Lisa's told me that she has trouble with this in general, not with the village, just the idea of Christ being the way.
Okay.
So narrow-minded.
So she has a problem with
it.
Yeah.
Holding to Christ.
Okay. So that this is a family, and she feels pushed out. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, intrusive.
Intrusive.
Yeah, very intrusive in other people's lives.
Intrusive people. Any, Gary?
Well, just, I mean, if Craig was here, I'm sure he wouldn't mind sharing this, but just, you know, through his experience, you know, in the band and seeing the way you guys have supported the band and everything, he's seen, you know, he's told me on more than one occasion that he sees a definite genuineness in the people here. That, you know, he grew up in church, and he says he never would see the genuineness here that was lacking in his upbringing. So, you know, it worked both ways.
So he sees a genuineness. So what are some of the good things that people might think? We'll take off with Craig and we'll go. What are some of the good things?
Honest.
Anything else you might have heard? Intrusive?
But that's a good thing, too.
It's
a community.
Involvement and caring.
Lack of protection.
Yeah, it's not a
okay.
Pizza.
Pizza. Pizza. Friendly.
Casual.
Casual.
Everybody knows each other.
Everybody knows each other.
Nothing is ostracized.
Okay. So, what does this community here struggle with when it comes to loving one another? What do we have problems with? Where is it where we're like, I don't like what Jesus is asking us to do in this community?
We're depressed.
Okay, we're depressed.
Sometimes we have trouble with new people. Like, okay, time to get to know another person, take that effort. Yep.
So we like it this way, and we don't want to get to know other people. Sorry, new people, if you're here. We don't want to get to know. We'll try to do better tonight. Ryan. So being loved is a hard thing for us. Not cultural.
Yeah.
What are some of the other? I would say discipline is a struggle for us. Being.
What makes you say that?
Because I'm the pastor, I could say that. James.
I want to say something about my family. It's like my family sees something about this church that somehow you're loved in the church, but yet you're not loved the same way by your family, and they're somewhat jealous, and they don't know how to respond to it. And what I would see is I want to encourage them to join, just get involved, and they're like, oh, that's okay, you got friends, that's cool. And they just don't know how to...
But hard to access, maybe. Okay. So, what are the good things that we do? What are, as us, as people, interacting with each other? If those are some of the harder things.
I think it's that we are small, we are a community.
So there's community. That's a good thing.
I think one of the main differences is that people don't look away. You know, when one person has a struggle and admits to this struggle, and the one's looking on, they don't look away. You know, like you discussed, or trying to be uninvolved.
Okay. So people don't. Hard to remain stagnant.
Yeah. They're really good at taking care of single people.
Good at taking care of single people.
The best yet that I've been. I have my years of experience.
I wanted to have this conversation. It's humorous to me. I spent like 6 months really meditating over this, and you guys hit almost every point I have in my notes, so I didn't have to say any of them. Did a good job, and I really wanted just us to talk about what it means as a community to love each other. Because according to Jesus, that's how people are going to know. And we do live in a culture that is really struggling with having intimacy with each other, having community at all. That it's just difficult. And so if they look here, maybe we'll be able to imitate Jesus enough for them to get a taste of that. In closing, I just want to read another verse out of this that really struck me and really is what really made me just cry a lot and kind of reflect on my own life from my earlier story. And that was when it says that when Jesus had said this, he became troubled in spirit. When Jesus, almost as if the gravity of Judas going to betray him hit him, it troubled his emotions, is literally what it troubled his stomach. It's as if, in some senses, I don't even know. I mean, I don't know how Jesus works this, but I don't think Jesus maybe even knew all the time that Judas was going to betray him, in the sense that he just made himself vulnerable. And that's kind of how I made myself to this person. I just opened myself up, not for any, I didn't protect myself. So even if Jesus knew Judas was going to betray him, it was as if he just dumped him whole. He said, "Here I am. You can have all of me, Judas." And then it hits him how emotionally disturbing it is to be naked in front of people. And I think one of the most terrifying things for me in context of community is to be naked. Not physically, but physically it would be terrifying. But emotionally, it's really a scary thing. It's not good for people to see you. It's too painful to say, "Here I am. Here's all that I have to offer. I'm going to love you selflessly, or I'm going to try to do that," and then just be rejected, or to have what I have to offer be rejected, or maybe it isn't as good as somebody else. There's all these fears bound up in that. And even if I'm not sinning in any of that by being controlled by my fears of other people, just being vulnerable like Jesus is not necessarily a fun state, in the sense of it's good to offer yourself, but often you're going to be hurt. And the temptation, I think, and what the world does is they offer themselves, they're hurt, they back away. Not going to offer that. Nope. And we've done that. We say, you don't like that? I'll try to find something else that's safer for me to offer. And so I guess what I'd like to encourage you in the context of chapter 13 is first to read it over and over again, because it's so cool the way Jesus washes the disciples' feet and takes off all of his clothing and just takes off all that encumbers him to really pour himself into serving people. And then also just that challenge to really, what does it mean to directionally love people, to choose to love people? And as Benji said, okay, I'm not going to think about myself right now. So that, for the rest of time tonight, we're going to take communion. We don't have our candles tonight, but we do have the sinner's chair back there. If you can, and you feel like you have some things that you want to confess, or you just feel overwhelmed by other people's sin and you want to sit there and be prayed for, you can kind of squeeze yourself back there and sit in that. We're going to have communion, and everyone here is welcome to have communion as long as you can say that you stand with Jesus and his body and his broken body and his blood. It's a confession of faith for us here. So you're welcome to come up and dip the bread in the juice. And so we're going to take a little bit of time now, and we're just going to meditate. Probably about 5 minutes. There's going to be some guitar playing. There'll be a Celtic confession on the screen. And so after I pray, you can just sit quietly. There's not as much room to look at the art yet. We'll figure out how to make it so it's better for you to walk around and look at things. You can come up and take communion. And the last thing in response tonight is offering. And if you're visiting with us, we're just happy to have you. So don't feel like you're obligated. This is a weird kind of organization of things, so just sort of pass the basket around and make sure people get it. So as we meditate, let's just think about, what does it mean to love one another? Let's pray. Again, Lord, I just come before you with my community, with all of our struggles, with all of our strengths. And Lord, I just ask that you would speak to us as we sing, as we meditate, as we take communion, as we pray, that you would enlighten us on what it means to love one another like you love us. And I ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen.